sixth case this morning, U.S. versus Clinton.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jeff Schlesinger on behalf of defendant appellant Jason Clinton. I believe that we raised two issues on appeal, the legality of the search, which I believe was adequately addressed in the brief, so I'd like to use my time to address the second issue concerning the impact of Mr. Clinton's criminal recklessness conviction from the state of Indiana upon his federal sentence. And I did not mention it in the brief, but just so the court is aware, it made a six-level difference in Clinton's offense level. He was already he wouldn't be category criminal six, which is the maximum in either event, but the range for level 22, which the court did find he was at, is 84 to 105 months. The court sentenced him 100 months. Without that criminal recklessness conviction being considered a crime of violence, his level would have been 16. The range is 46 to 57 months. So there's approximately almost a four-year difference and almost a double sentence based upon the fact that that criminal recklessness conviction was found to be a crime of violence. Now, this circuit has already ruled, has already addressed the Indiana criminal recklessness statute in United States versus Smith, and that case did find that statute need not be determined a crime of violence and did approve a procedure to look at the facts of the underlying conviction in a limited fashion, looking only at the charging information. I believe the evidence from a trial can be considered. In this case, Mr. Clinton had pled guilty to criminal recklessness, so the court was permitted to review the colloquy of his plea agreement to see what facts he admitted to establish that he was guilty of criminal recklessness in Indiana. In Smith, Smith specifically held that a crime of violence does not include crimes with a mens rea of negligence or recklessness, and the Indiana statute indicates that the act can be taken with either a knowing, intentional, or reckless state of mind. Smith then did establish a procedure, and we agree that Judge Van Bachlen did follow the appropriate procedure and look back at the facts. And I believe I did. Smith does talk about the types of crimes that permit additional evaluation, and specifically says that if a statute, if an underlying criminal statute encompasses multiple categories of offense conduct, some of which would constitute a violent felony and some of which would not, those are the types of statutes that can be evaluated. In my brief, I did indicate that I believed that the criminal recklessness statute was not divisible. I believe, upon further reading of Smith and the subsequent cases, Woods and Evans, I believe that it is divisible, and it's a difficult distinction to make because most of the cases examined in both the Supreme Court case and Seventh Circuit cases, a lot of them have separate categories. Burglaries are dealt with a lot in United States v. Begay, the United States Supreme Court. Several other courts cite a Massachusetts statute that has, I believe, nine different categories from breaking and entering. And this court had dealt with the Illinois escape statute where there can be a violent escape or simply failing to report when on leave from a criminal, from a confinement can also be considered, and look at those separate categories. The Indiana statute is somewhat different in that the categories are not set out as A, B, and C, but I believe that because Smith did go on to examine the facts of the conviction, Smith would consider Indiana statute to be divisible in that it can be committed with three separate states of mind. Clearly, if it were negligence, I'm sorry, recklessness, then it would not be a crime of violence. Now, the facts of the underlying conviction that the court looked at, Clinton had been at his own home, and he got into an argument. I believe he was playing pool, and they were doing cocaine with another individual. The individual had threatened him, followed him up the stairs. Clinton pulled a knife and stabbed the individual. It's not clear. He's clearly stabbed him more than one time, but
according to the colloquy, three times in the stomach, chest, and cut his wrist, and conceded that the guy he stabbed, Foreman, was unarmed.
Correct. He was clearly unarmed. I don't think it's...
Sounds pretty purposeful.
Well, and I'm not disputing that either. I'm not sure that two of those wounds could have been received from the same stab, I believe, under the colloquy. But that's not really a critical point. He clearly went beyond the normal, the boundaries of self-defense, which he did admit to the trial court as well. Now, in all the cases which are dealing with the definition of crime of violence, I have not been able to find a case in which similar to this, in which an individual may have been acting in self-defense, possibly with one stab wound, and then goes beyond that. But as I'm sure this court is aware, in state courts, that type of situation does come up pretty often. And I believe that, Woods decision even did talk about the fact that this the prosecution may charge a lesser offense. There are a large number of offenses which result from bar fights or possible original assaults.
Even in Indiana?
I'm sorry?
Even in Indiana?
Yeah.
Near the state law.
Near
the state law.
Just across from Calumet City. Other than that, it's fine.
Well, it's very near Chicago.
We're from Lake County, so we're very near Chicago anyway. We probably consider ourselves part of Illinois, but we are bound by Indiana law. This is something that has not been addressed, and the courts have, in the crimes the courts have dealt with, they've created rules to follow to determine whether it's a crime of violence that I don't think really clearly apply to this type of situation. Begay, I believe, is interesting, and I do believe it's relevant to this case, in that the Begay court dealt with a New Mexico drunk driving statute, which the Supreme Court held not to be a crime of violence, and the court pointed out that the conduct of drinking was intentional, the conduct of driving was intentional, but there was a reckless consequence in that there could be a danger to another person. I believe that Clinton's situation can fall within those facts, in that clearly it's an intentional act when you stab someone, whether you're acting in self-defense or not. But it's legal as long as you're acting in self-defense. And Indiana, as most jurisdictions, has a self-defense statute.
You're in your rebuttal time.
I understand. Thank you. But then his conduct became reckless when he went beyond that and continued to stab him. Obviously, the trial court recognized a lower moral culpability, if not mental culpability, by allowing him to plead to criminal recklessness. But what I want to point out is that, it's really difficult for me to follow the procedures outlined in a number of these cases, including Woods, which there was a dissent on this court concerning. But I think it's important to look back to the 3553 factors and the purposes of sentencing. This is a situation in which he received almost double the time, and there's really no purpose under 35. Well, there's one purpose that does fit it, but I don't believe it can be any deterrence because of the judicial conflict over the definition of crime of violence. I could certainly not advise a client as to whether something might be considered a crime of violence in the future, and there may be additional rulings on that. Certainly there is a purpose for protecting the public, and that would be served by locking him up for a longer period of time. But if you go back and look at the conduct, acting in self-defense, even if you go beyond that, is not the type of person who has aggressive, violent, or purposeful conduct and would go out and needs society needs to be protected from. Thank you.
Thank you. Four.
Thank you, Your Honor. Josh Kohler for the United States. When someone punches someone in a bar fight, they do so intentionally. When someone stabs someone multiple times in the chest, the stomach, and the wrist, they do so intentionally. That is the issue in this case. Defense counsel raised two issues in his brief, one going to suppression, one going to sentencing. He has rested on the suppression issue, and the government will do the same unless there are any questions from the court. As to the sentencing issue, one of the defendant's many prior convictions was for criminal recklessness, and that involved the repeated stabbing of a victim. Now, as this court pointed out in United States v. Smith, the statute at issue here, the Indiana criminal reckless statute, criminalizes non-purposeful conduct as well as purposeful conduct. So what the court did here, under the parameters set out in both Smith and the United States Supreme Court case of Shepard, the court looked to the plea colloquy and decided how the defendant violated this statute. The statute has three states of mind that are at issue. It's either knowing and or reckless, or the higher standard of intentional. And the court's job in this case was to determine whether or not the defendant's prior crime and the plea colloquy and the issues that he admitted to were intentional acts, or whether they could be knowing or reckless. The court made the proper determination here that the plea colloquy demonstrated intentional acts, and as such, it would qualify as a crime of violence under the Supreme Court tests laid out in Begay and Chambers, as well as this court's recent 2008 decision in United States v. Smith. I will just address briefly a couple of defense counsel's comments regarding the effect of the crime of violence determination. And while the crime of violence determination did increase the defendant's guideline sentence, Judge Van Bocklin was very careful to go through the 3553A factors in this case. In fact, he accepted briefs on the issue of 3553A factors, and at sentencing mentioned that he had considered those 3553A factors and found the briefs to be very persuasive and important in his ruling. I don't think it's entirely accurate to say that the mere determination of the crime of violence doubled the sentence. It did increase the guideline sentence, which is one of the factors the judge considered. But it's also important to keep in mind that one of the reasons it increased the guideline sentence so much dealt not only with the fact that the court determined that it was a crime of violence, but the criminal history level that this defendant's previous crimes put him at. And that criminal history level was not increased because of the crime of violence determination. In short, Your Honor, I feel that the district court's decision was supported by the record, that the finding that the prior crime was an intentional one and not knowing and reckless is respectfully the only finding that is supported by the plea colloquy that was introduced at the defendant's sentencing. If there are no further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
You have 1 minute, Mr. Sessions.
With due respect to Mr. Kohler, I believe he's just wrong about the fact that the intentional conduct is all the court has to look at. And also, the criminal history was the same, and my guideline calculation ranges were under either criminal history. The crime of violence was specifically what increased it by over 40 months. And the decisions also make clear, however, the trial court can impose a higher sentence. But as this court knows, the reality is that the trial courts typically still do guideline sentences. I think it's like 75% or something. So when that's a starting point, and if the court incorrectly calculates that, then this court should reverse and remand for resentencing. Mr. Clinton also got a triple whammy in this case. He got he served his time on the criminal recklessness. He got a higher criminal history, which is reflected in his guideline range either way. And he gets the crime of violence enhanced. Thank you.
Mr. Sussinger, you took this case by appointment?
Yes.
Thank you very much. You have appreciation of the court.